Hello and welcome back to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me this week, as ever, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello, Fraser.
And we're delighted to welcome founder of the Free Speech Union, Toby Young.
Hi.
We've got plenty to talk about today. We're going to be discussing the Europe-wide crackdown on free speech, the tyranny of the smoking ban, and the, I guess you'd call it, a woke lunatic who has taken over America's national public radio. So earlier this week, the NatCon event in Brussels was shut down, or attempted to be shut down, by the police. The police sort of arrived en masse when Nigel Farage took to the stage. This wasn't the first attempt to shut it down. In fact, it was already the third venue the organisers were on by the time the police arrived under orders from a local mayor. I mean, Toby, what have you made of this? I mean, does this speak to sort of a Europe-wide trend?
Well, it does, certainly. I've written in The Spectator this week about how it isn't just in Scotland that there is a legislative assault on free speech. Mm. There are very similar bills bubbling away in different European countries. There's one in Ireland. There's one in Northern Ireland, not yet a bill, but almost a bill, will be soon. There's one in Poland. In Poland, Donald Tusk's government, or a member of his government, wants to amend an existing law to make defamation of members of the LGBTQ community an offence punishable by 3 years in prison. And it looks like that will sail through. And, of course, the worst example is Canada.
Yes.
Not in Europe, but it isn't just a Europe-wide phenomenon. But I'm sure you've already talked about the Canadian online harms bill. But one of the most egregious aspects of that is that people can be placed under house arrest if the authorities deem they're likely to disseminate hate speech, say something hateful on social media before they even have. I mean, it's like you imagine that Philip K. Dick, when writing the Minority Report, went about as far as he thought he could. But this goes way further than that, because the only people arrested for pre-crimes in Minority Report were people who were thought likely to commit very serious crimes,
yeah,
like murder. And they weren't doing this just on the say-so of a kind of police functionary, but precogs, these kind of vat-dwelling freaks who could literally see the future. Here, it's a much more tenuous basis on which people are being placed under house arrest and prevented from using any of their communication devices, even to the extent of having ankle bracelets attached to them. And if the police suspect that you're at risk of getting drunk and ignoring the ban on communicating because you're likely to say something hateful, they can insist that you do these regular bodily fluid tests. You have to piss in a jar every couple of weeks, and some inspector comes around and kind of examines it, lest you get drunk and engage in drunken tweeting, tweeting under the influence. So yeah, so it's certainly not an isolated episode. I mean, one of the things which struck me though about it was how incredibly kind of cack-handed the whole attempt to shut down NatCon was, and in the end it didn't succeed. But you sort of think, I mean, all these efforts to shut down dissent, challenges to, the ideological status quo, not just in Europe, but across the English-speaking world, they all seem to be predicated on this sort of assumption that if you suppress dissent, that's the best way of dealing with it.
Yeah,
The best way to shore up their power, cling on to power, preserve the regime, is not to engage in argument in the public square and set out the case for the policies you want to defend, but to just, scream no debate, you're beyond the pale, or you're trafficking in misinformation and disinformation. You have no place in the public square, as though that's going to address the kind of brewing populist revolt in Europe, and which is likely to, see, people like Macron swept from power eventually. It's just so wrong-headed, and it's sort of reminiscent of how the Austro-Hungarian Empire or Tsarist Russia might have responded to dissent, to reach for the censorship levers rather than to, understand that the best way, if you think that what this group of political leaders are advocating is toxic and dangerous and poses a threat to democracy, then, debate them in the public square. Isn't sunlight the best disinfectant disinfectant. Isn't that the lesson we learn from the unsuccessful attempts of these autocratic regimes in the 19th century to shore up their power? Isn't that the lesson, you know, that counter speech is more effective than the suppression of speech? But apparently that lesson has now been forgotten. And now there are just all these incredibly heavy-handed and in some cases cack-handed efforts to demonize and silence anyone who dissents from the kind of radical progressive agenda as though that will save them.
I mean, certainly the way European politics is going, it's not as if people are in love with the technocratic elites after all their censorship efforts, Tom.
No, it's a reminder that really it is the existing governing elites, the existing establishment that is the true threat to our fundamental freedoms. I mean, it does seem that a narrative had taken hold amongst these various Brussels mayors, both the mayor of Brussels itself, but also the kind of individual sort of municipal mayors, that they were basically shutting down a meeting of the far right. That, you know, this is the sort of wellspring of a new authoritarianism, that these right-wing populists are going to, or conservatives are going to get into power, and they're suddenly going to use the police as their own kind of professional political censors, that they're going to send in the boys whenever there's a meeting. You know, that it's going to bring us back to the darkest days of the 1930s. So that what they then do as a consequence of this is they get the police and use them as their personal goon squad to shut down a meeting that they fundamentally disagree with. I mean, it was interesting how quickly that you almost saw them pulling back. So it was absolutely outrageous, of course, the fact that the organisers had to, they're on their third venue, which was basically a kind of wedding venue, because all of the other big hotels and places that they were supposed to hold the conference in had to pull out under pressure from this, basically from the mayor's office. But then also that they send in the police, absolutely outrageous. At one point, they weren't letting anyone in. People, Miriam Cates, Conservative MP, had to be smuggled in the back door, apparently with a headscarf on. Really petty things as well. So seemingly under the direction of that local mayor in that part of Brussels, a gentleman called Amir Kerr, the Tunisian owner of the venue had his car towed. They were blocking the caterers from getting inside. but there was also this kind of pulling back, because I think they realised this looks outrageous. You had police showing up at whatever you think about it. It was a political conference. It was an event where people were exchanging ideas. And that because essentially that they had taken offence to it, that they disagreed with it, that for all kinds of fantastical reasons they decided it had to be stopped, was being treated as a police matter. I mean, they had their kind of trumped up reasons for this, decided it was going to be a threat to public order, because I think a handful of kind of Antifa had threatened to hold a protest at one part of the day. But it was quite clearly a clear-cut example of political censorship using the police. And yet this is supposedly in order to defend Europe and defend Belgium against similarly authoritarian forces. So the irony seems to be lost on them, but it should be lost on us, I guess.
At one point, I think the mayor who did try and shut down the third venue, Claridge, he, as you say, invoked the risk of disorder because of the planned Antifa protest, which incidentally never really materialised. I think 15 people stood at one end of the street kind of wearing ski masks. That was it. But he actually said that this conference poses a danger to public safety. And it's like you'd think, you know, Robespierre invoked public safety as an excuse to kind of unleash a kind of wave of bloodletting during the French Revolution. You'd think that the concept of public safety as a pretext for shutting down free speech, you'd think that would have been discredited by now. But apparently not. He invoked the concept of public safety to try and justify shutting it down. I think it was quite encouraging that the police kind of did step back a bit. I think they intended and had been ordered to literally shut it down and clear the building. But when they met a little bit of opposition and when they were surrounded by TV cameras and realised it was all in the glare of the media spotlight, they backed off and just stopped people entering the building. And that's why it became known as the NatCon siege, because, you know, caterers couldn't get in. It was all quite comic. But someone who was there told me that when this supposedly far-right Catholic cardinal appeared, far right, presumably because he actually follows Catholic doctrine when it comes to gay marriage. When he appeared, all the Belgian police officers, who of course are Catholic to a man, parted like the Red Sea. They weren't going to stop a Prince of Rome entering the venue. They almost started tugging their forelocks when he appeared, even though he was supposedly far right. But
if you want to hold an event in Brussels, you know what to do. You've got to invite one of these cardinals. Get out of jail free.
But Yaram Hazony and the other organisers of NatCon must be rubbing their hands with glee. I mean, it's sort of, extraordinarily good publicity mm-hmm. for NatCon. I mean, you know, they're now at the forefront of the resistance against kind of liberal authoritarianism, and everything they've been saying, as you said, Tom, about the progressive elite's abandonment of democratic norms, supposedly in defense of democracy, has now been proved true. I mean, it couldn't be a better illustration of the alarm they've been sounding about the abandonment of democratic norms by, you know, ruling parties across Europe and the wider world. I mean, it was just a total own goal on the part of mm-hmm. the Belgian authorities.
Definitely, definitely. I just want to touch on an event similarly shut down, or actually successfully shut down in this case, on the other side of the political spectrum. So last week, a Palestine conference in Berlin was kind of shut down within not long with it starting. The under the orders from the Berlin mayor, the police turned up, pulled the plug while someone was giving a speech remotely. Yanis Varoufakis, people may remember him, the Greek finance minister, was banned from attending. He was, in fact, he was banned from all political activity on German soil in relation to this speech, which meant he couldn't even give his speech remotely. So clearly, Tom, I mean, this is something that touches across the whole political spectrum. It's not, you know, it's always been nonsense to say that free speech is a right-wing concern. Mm-hmm. And this just proves it.
Oh, it does, absolutely. And I think it's a reminder of why anyone who truly does hold to those fundamental liberal principles and rights. You just need to defend free speech and the right to assemble and the right to hold public meetings for absolutely everyone. And it's actually been relatively encouraging to see some voices on the kind of Israelophobic left actually find their principles in relation to this and actually even make statements not just about this conference in Berlin, but also about the Brussels NatCon conference, because it's quite clear that they're both being subject to the same kind of censorious forces. Mm-hmm. What I think is really concerning is that a sort of notion which has been pretty palpable in a lot of kind of centre-left European circles for some time, this kind of idea of like militant democracy. Like the thing is that we have to use the state power in order to crush forces, which if we allow them to sort of germinate, they will lead to reactionary, authoritarian, even fascist things to take root in our societies. This is something that's actually been very central to sort of German policy for basically in the post-war period. But that's become kind of very mainstream across the piece. And I think what we're seeing demonstrated in all of this is what a folly that approach to these things are. First of all, because you end up kind of destroying democratic rights in the name of protecting them, but also because what is considered so beyond the pale that it must be crushed, that category seems to be growing and growing. I mean, to the point where in Brussels, it even includes a range of either conservative to just more sort of right-wing populist figures. And even, you know, some of the speakers at this particular conference in Berlin, I mean, it seems to focus around Palestinian gentlemen by the name of Salman Abu Sitta, who was giving his address over Zoom, essentially, when they cut the power off in order to cut him down. It's not to say that this he in particular is and has said some deeply unsavory things. He wrote an essay just after, I think it was in January, in fact, where he talks about if he was still in Gaza on October 7th, he would have joined the brave young men who retook their territory. As he put it, he completely denies that any atrocities have taken place and has previously referred to Israelis as European ghetto dwellers who came and stole our land. It's not to say that in all circumstances that when people are shut down, that there's not they aren't generally genuinely unsavory in some respects. Yeah. But this is not the way you tackle it. And just whenever you've got a situation in which you're seeing the police being sent in to break up peaceful public meetings in a European city, that really should send chills down people's spines, I think. These are fundamental liberties to our nations, you know, and the fact that they're being so easily trampled upon, even while sometimes they claim to have the heart in the right place, we've just got to clear that out of the way and make this a question of principle, which hopefully that will start to creep back into the discussion.
And it's encompassing even, you know, elected figures like, well, Varoufakis was elected, you know.
Well, the current German government is talking about banning AFD as though that would be a way to deal with, you know, their critique of globalization, net zero, mass immigration. You said, Tom, that it's been a characteristic of Germany's post-war policy and its kind of paranoid way of trying to suppress any hint of far-right nationalism. But actually, it was a characteristic of Germany's pre-war policy, too, as I think you've written about in the past. And very much the same tactics were used to try and prevent the growth of Nazism. So various forms of hate speech were criminalized in different German states in the 1920s and early 1930s, and various prominent Nazis were prosecuted and in some cases imprisoned. It didn't stop the rise of Nazism. I mean, my question to both of you is, given how ineffective this tactic is for dealing with the rise of populist right-wing movements, why is it, and given that they've been proven to be ineffective, and will later this year, I think, be proved to be catastrophically ineffective as populist parties triumph across the board, why are they nevertheless, you know, repeating those mistakes? Mm. Is it because they're not confident enough of what it is they actually believe to defend those beliefs and defend their policies in the public square? Are their values so brittle that they don't think they could be exposed to that kind of challenge publicly, and so they therefore have to shut down the challenges? Is it because that even though they actually are confident and they know what arguments they could present to defend their positions, they don't think it's worthwhile doing that in the public square because they have such contempt for ordinary people? They think it would just be lost on them. The best we can do is just repeat slogans like "trans women are women" or "you're far right" and hope that they land. Or we can use the techniques developed by behavioral scientists and try and nudge people into compliance with our radical progressive agenda, because actually trying to persuade them in a kind of honest, upfront, democratic way will obviously not work because they're far too stupid and uneducated to take any of that in. I mean, why is it that they've abandoned debate and have resorted to censorship as a way to try and shore up their power when we know that doesn't work?
I think from what you laid out, there's almost a bit of column A and a bit of column B. I think there is an element of the fact that they have such a low view of ordinary people, therefore they see censorship as a kind of necessary, almost public health measure. Like, we have to kind of impose these limits on speech, otherwise these idiots will be easily won over by it. And there's also a fundamental thing is, as the kind of technocratic establishment has drifted so far away from ordinary people, their democratic legitimacy, their roots into society have so kind of withered on the vine, that the more they realise that they can't persuade people, the more they realise they have to compel them. And I think that's become a really powerful and kind of almost self-perpetuating dynamic. They realise that they're really distant from these people that they rely on to be in power, but they also know that they have no way of connecting with them. So what they're left with is state power, is authoritarianism, is censorship. And it is also, I think, an expression of just how almost uncertain they are in their own position. You get this feeling with a lot of politicians at the moment, where if the right-wing populists didn't exist, they would have to invent them, because they have no other raison d'etre other than to say, we are going to keep them out. Mm. The Democrats, we're the ones to keep Trump out. Mm. Any of these, Macron, I'm the one who will keep Le Pen from the gates.
Yeah.
This is all they have, but it feels like almost they're by not just... they almost still can't present any kind of meaningful alternative anyway, which is not them. So therefore it becomes more and more tempting for them to silence them.
And maybe there's a kind of a third aspect to this, which you sort of touched upon there, which is that why bother to win the debate when it doesn't really matter who wins elections, because, you know, the deep state remains in control, without drifting too far into Liz Truss territory. But I'm sure there's an element of that too. Okay, we might lose the forthcoming, you know, European Parliament election.
We know that those don't really matter.
It doesn't really matter because the Eurocrats remain in charge. And there's probably an element of that thinking, you know, into why expend valuable time and resources on trying to persuade people of the wisdom of our policies in a kind of straightforward democratic manner, when it doesn't really matter who wins elections, we're still going to be in charge.
I'm sure they sense that.
Definitely. Right, let's talk about Rishi Sunak's smoking ban. It passed quite comfortably in its first reading in the House of Commons. So it could soon be the case that anyone born after 2008 will never be allowed to ever buy legally buy a tobacco product. The aim is to create a smoke-free England. Tom, what have you made of this?
Well, it's thoroughly depressing, but it was also... the writing's been on the wall for some time. I think it's fair to say. Not only was this policy had already been announced at Tory party conference to much fanfare, finally Rishi Sunak has had a vision for the country, and that was that young people will never be able to buy cigarettes, which is a strange kind of legacy. But I think it was also a reminder of how ineffectual sort of Tory opposition to nanny state feels like a bit of a weak term for this, but in this case, full-blown prohibition, really. But whilst there's always been a kind of a section of that party will talk a good game on these matters, there's not enough of them. And even then, some of them, their kind of scruples disappear, actually, in the course of these votes and these actual debates. But there's so much about it. I mean, there's the fundamental kind of liberal point about the fact that as long as you're not harming anyone else, you should be able to do whatever you like. You should be able to consume what you like. The fact that that's completely evaporated is a kind of cross-party consensus now that that's a ridiculous way to govern a country is thoroughly depressing. And it's not going to stop here either. This idea that it's just about smoking, I think, is ridiculous. But also, it's just how stupid it is. I mean, the way they talk about these young people will never be able to buy cigarettes. Now, young people aren't really smoking anyway, for reasons we might get into. But it's also the fact that they seem completely blind to the idea that there is this thing called the black market and that it might actually grow as a consequence of this. Mm. And the fact that every time you try to impose even just taxes and more petty restrictions on something like smoking, it's a boon to the bootleggers and always has been. So it's an absurd policy. I hope it will kind of collapse under the weight of its own absurdity. Like when you've got a situation where a 56-year-old is having to buy cigarettes for their 55-year-old neighbour because they haven't got the right identification, surely people will realise this is ridiculous. But at the same time, it's just it's the fact that what I thought was quite a fundamental principle of whatever you do is done as a government's business as long as it doesn't harm anyone else has just evaporated now.
Yeah. And Toby, I mean, we live in a time when we fetishize evidence-based policies. Surely one of the most important iron laws of politics is that prohibition doesn't work. I mean, we're kind of talking about this in the last section. We know that hate speech laws don't work and they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, technically, this is supposed to be a heroin-free country, a cocaine-free country. Yes. Why do they keep going? Why do they talk as if this is the end of cigarettes?
I know, it's odd, isn't it? When you think about how ineffective the marijuana ban has been. Mm. I mean, the ineffectiveness of the marijuana ban is often cited as a reason to, you know, decriminalise marijuana use. Yeah. And yet here they are trying the same thing with tobacco. It's so odd that Rishi decided to make this his kind of flagship die-in-a-ditch policy. I mean, there's so much that he could be trying to address, and he's chosen this to focus on. It's like it shows just how politically kind of tone deaf he is. This and making maths compulsory up to the age of 18. Mm.
Well, yeah, people suggest it's just his personal preferences, things that he likes.
Maybe. It's like, if Labour are going to lower the voting age to 16, you know, what can I do to make sure that they can look at the Conservative Party and take us seriously? I know, we'll make them do maths, you know, until they're 18. That'll really make them vote for us. Just to take issue with something you said, Tom, you said that the kind of, J.S. Mill's principle that if an action is entirely self-regarding and doesn't pose any potential harm to anyone else, then why is the government legislating about it and trying to ban it? Isn't the argument, I think, a spurious one, but the argument is that smoking isn't entirely self-regarding, that it harms others in the form of secondhand smoke. Mm-hmm. We actually published some pieces in the Daily Skeptic by John Stadden, a professor of psychology emeritus at Dartmouth College in the US, who's actually wrote a book about secondhand smoke and the evidence that secondhand smoke actually does cause, you know, respiratory diseases like lung cancer is so threadbare as to be, you know, virtually non-existent. Mm-hmm. But that is the argument. And when people want to, ban various forms of speech and classify them as hate speech, the argument often is that allowing people to say, for instance, trans women aren't women, actually causes vulnerable communities harm. And we need to legislate to ban this in order to protect these vulnerable communities. It's always a spurious argument, but I suppose we can at least take some comfort from the fact that they are nevertheless trying to kind of make the argument in a way which is kind of compatible with Mill's harm principle.
They are, but I think that's always been spurious as well. I mean, even when the smoking ban came in 2007, the idea that this was about just protecting people and barmaids, etc., from secondhand smoke, that was proven wrong quite quickly when they also included things like, you know, tradesmen couldn't smoke in their own vans or you couldn't smoke on open train platforms and things like this. It was always about control rather than actually about about trying to just kind of protect people. And especially at this point in time where, you know, the days of people kind of smoking at their desk in the office or smoking at the cinema or smoking on the airplane, at the airplane, they are well and truly over.
You know?
And whether or not you want to take issue with those restrictions, the idea at this point in time, we need to go further and kind of ban smoking is so ridiculous. But I do wish that, because there is such a kind of cross-party consensus on this, and because of the fact that smoking has been declining. It's a relatively small portion of the population at this point. It's also a quite acceptable prejudice to be against people who smoke, to be almost viscerally disgusted by it. Wes Streeting often gives vent to that particular prejudice. The fact that it's even that point, even to the point where the places in which people can smoke is so restricted, the fact that it's now pretty much your own house or outside or whatever, the fact that you are still not allowed to indulge this ghastly preference of yours in peace, I think does reflect a real shift in how we understand the balance between the individual and the state in this country. And I think also where smoking is concerned, it's always been tainted by snobbery. There's always been this kind of sense of the sort of people who smoke and they should be protected from their own ghastly habits. And the fact that it succeeded, I think, is a real blow to that England of just live and let live. Mm. It's just people haven't quite got to grips with that yet. And it's also definitely not going to stop at cigarettes. Yeah,
and it's become a cliche, but when did you last hear someone say, it's a free country?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't hear it anymore, do you?
I mean, it's worth stressing that, you know, the government is extending a lot of its sort of nanny state policies to things that are not even harmful to the individual. I mean, you think the ban on NOS, on laughing gas, a substance so harmful that they give it to pregnant women. Mm. The ban on vaping. Now, vaping is not, you know, a health cure, but it's certainly nowhere near as bad as smoking. And, you know, it answers, as you've made this point many times, Tom, it answers that question of, you know, what would we do if we invented it, if someone would invent a cigarette that was not harmful, that came with another harm that people complain about. Well, we've done that and they still don't want people to.
Which is part of this bill as well. They want to clamp down on, it's a little bit vague on the vape section, but it seems like a clamp down on flavours is in the offing, as well as taxes on vape juice and so on. And that's another reminder that this is just about control really, at the end of the day. I mean, because of the fact that this has been presented as we need to stop kids smoking. Obviously kids aren't allowed to smoke anyway, so that's a slightly, but you know, the future generations from ever taking it up. Amongst young people, I think between 18 and 24 year olds, the smoking rate has like halved over the course of the past 10 years. And a lot of that is down to vaping. And it's not proving to really be a gateway towards smoking. They're just kind of having that and stopping it. So the fact that not only are they kind of trying to create a problem where it isn't, young people are not taking up smoking in large numbers, and also simultaneously are clamping down on what, if you wanted to put it in public health terms, has been the best harm reduction invention ever in relation to smoking, I think tells you that this was always about Puritanism, really. Yeah. It was just about, as you know, Mencken put it, all of our leaders seem to be gripped by this paralyzing fear that someone somewhere might be enjoying themselves in a way that they don't like. That seems to be what's going on. But just finally on Toby's point about the lack of vision that Rishi Sunak has, apart from on these really absurd, petty nanny state issues, I think there's a relationship between those two things. I think, you know, even when New Labour got really into the politics of lifestyle, it was telling that they come into power, they make the Bank of England independent, they relinquish control over this huge area of economic life, and then suddenly they think, you know what we need to do? We need to seize power over the smoking policy of every pub in the land. Mm. It's almost like the more that politics shrinks, the more that the state wants to get more involved in your business. And also the less that a politician has any sense of vision for society, has any kind of ambition for what he can achieve in office, the more he just sees the kind of improvement of the public as more of his kind of jurisdiction. I think Sunak's a good example of that.
Maybe part of the explanation, Tom, is that any society has a kind of fixed quantity of things it wants to ban, police, prescribe. And as society loosens up in some respects, so as it becomes more sexually permissive, as it becomes more acceptable to engage in all kinds of sexual preferences, as it becomes more acceptable to change your gender and so forth, as we become much less kind of religious with respect to the policing of that whole dimension of our lives, so to compensate, because we can't cope with too much freedom, we have to start policing things like smoking in the home, what people can see on the internet. And you can see, actually, I think there really is, there does seem to be a pattern whereby the countries which have become the most authoritarian when it comes to the policing of language and speech, like Ireland, our country which was have only recently become kind of liberated mm-hmm. from the kind of puritanical diktats of Catholicism. You see it in Brazil too. Brazil has suddenly become incredibly authoritarian about just these things, mm-hmm. not about sex and gender. And it's as though the human psyche cannot cope with too much freedom. So if they become liberated in one area, they immediately have to become repressed in another.
Yeah. And certainly our leaders can't cope with us having too much freedom. Yeah. So even if you've got it in some areas, they'll yeah. take it when the others are.
I think that's probably the bigger problem. Right, so now let's move on to talk about the new CEO of NPR. She actually got the job in January, but she's kind of come to public attention after a veteran editor has essentially resigned. This editor, Yuri Berliner, said, the NPR, you know, this US publicly funded independent radio station, used to be open-minded. It isn't so much anymore. He was suspended and castigated for saying this. Mm. Obviously, they must think they are very open-minded. And has since resigned. The new CEO has caught people's attention because of some of her extremely kind of woke comments. She's been railing against free speech, against the open internet, in favour of rioting, in favour of every sort of BLM slogan going. Yeah, so here's a clip from her when she was actually head of Wikimedia, which runs Wikipedia, and this is her railing against the First Amendment.
The number one challenge here that we see and is, of course, the First Amendment in the United States is a fairly robust protection of rights. And that is a protection of rights both for platforms, which I actually think is very important that platforms have those rights to be able to regulate what kind of content they want on their sites. But it also means that it is a little bit tricky to really address some of the real challenges of where does bad information come from and sort of the influence peddlers who have made a real market economy around it.
So slightly terrifying, head of a very significant media organization in the US said the First Amendment is the problem. Toby, what do you make of this? I mean, there's obviously a broader pattern of the kind of awakening of American newsrooms. Yes.
Well, it's it does. She perfectly illustrates the capture of the kind of cathedrals of liberal America by the woke. She is so infected by what Elon Musk calls the woke mind virus that she's almost like a mirror image of Titania McGrath. I mean, I suggested to Andrew Doyle last night that he should produce a Titania thread in which Titania accuses Catherine Meyer of plagiarizing her because her tweets are so unbelievably Titania-like. It's just, it's like obviously no kind of self-awareness there.
But I have to pull you up actually on the pronunciation because she's pronounced Catherine Marr and okay. She has accused anyone who mispronounced it, especially Brits, because the BBC mispronounced her okay. of being colonialist.
Oh, okay.
It's Lord. A colonial
That's
hangover.
Exactly what
apparently.
Titania would say.
Yeah.
but yeah, this stuff she said, I mean, it is just extraordinary that the head of National Public Radio could call the First Amendment a problem. And she's made other speeches. She made this speech in which she talked about how the kind of mainstream US media was hamstrung by a reverence for the truth. Mm.
and, saying the know, quiet part out loud.
Yeah. Saying the quiet part out loud. And so she made this speech in which she said that the kind of mainstream media in the US was handicapped by its reverence for the truth. And she set out this sort of crude doctrine of sort of relativist doctrine. And she talked about the importance of acknowledging different people's truths and how the search for one truth, objective truth, created division and disharmony. And it would be better if we didn't think that our job as journalists was to pursue the truth, but to allow people to just have their truths and allow everyone to kind of just set out what they believe to be true about the world with no kind of attempt to kind of reconcile these different points of view. It was, I mean, one odd thing about that, I mean, of course, we know that the kind of American progressive ruling class has kind of drunk the postmodern Kool-Aid, and they all believe in this doctrine. They've been taught it as, you know, humanity students by grievance studies professors, and they've read Judith Butler and so forth, and they think everything's a social construct, and any attempt to try and define objective truth is just an act of kind of colonialist oppression and white supremacy and the rest of it. But what's odd is that they kind of, that they believe this, and they're perfectly happy to set it out in the way she's just done. But at the same time, in order to discredit anyone who challenges their agenda, they'll reach for the fact checkers.
They'll describe
what somebody's saying as misinformation or disinformation. It's like, well, hang on a minute. Isn't it you that is fetishizing factfulness as a way of trying to discredit your opponents? How do these two, how does the kind of reliance on fact checkers and this kind of visceral horror of disinformation and misinformation, how does that sit apparently perfectly happily alongside this kind of epistemological relativism, which is one of the core components of kind of postmodern doctrine?
It does seem a bit unfair that Catherine Marr is allowed to have, you know, her truth, and Kellyanne Conway can't have her alternative facts.
Yeah. What is the difference between those two things? Yeah, why can't you have the kind of Trumpist alternative ways of knowing as many people say? But no, it is striking because obviously people have been digging up a lot of her, not even, you know, particularly historical comments, you know, things from a couple of years ago when she was at Wikimedia or various other kind of elite institutions. And it is striking how kind of unfiltered that postmodern kind of gobbledygook, how they express it in such a kind of clear-cut way now. Like, this isn't something that's just in the water. Like, they're really paying, it's hit the American C-suite in a very big way. And I feel like so many of our problems are downstream of that. And it's causing such a huge problem for American journalism in particular. And I know that this gentleman who's just resigned was trying to kind of sound the alarm about this and is suspended and then resigns as a consequence of all that. But because you do just have institutions which once could rely on a certain level of kind of buy-in from the public. NPR, it's always had that kind of liberal skew, obviously, but at the same time, I think in his piece for the Free Press, he quotes the fact that, you know, up until relatively recently, it was only like 37% of their listenership were liberal, a good quarter or so were conservative. Now that's down to, I think, it's up to 67% liberal and like 10% conservative now. And it's a sort of telling that as the American newsroom has become more wokeified, the more and more it's turning people away. People just aren't trusting them. And one of the cases that he flags up, which is so telling, was when the Hunter Biden laptop story broke in 2020. And their managing editor went on air, on the record, to say, we're not interested in stories that aren't real stories. And unlike the New York Times or the Washington Post, who a couple of years later had to begrudgingly admit that the New York Post's original story that this laptop was Hunter Biden's, that there was incriminating material on it, that it did raise questions about his wheeler dealing in Ukraine and Joe Biden's potential involvement in that, that both the New York Times and the Washington Post issued a kind of mea culpa, but NPR never did. So it's just another example of how the more that the kind of American ruling class has become more woke, not only are they kind of eviscerating what are supposed to be their own journalistic principles, but also they're losing any legitimacy with the public. I mean, this is almost a kind of cartoonish example of that, of that they appoint this new CEO at this quite crucial juncture for them, and it's someone who, as Toby says, is indistinguishable from Zetania McGrath. It's incredible.
I mean, it's actually an interesting case study in the sort of psychology of the ultra woke. One of the curiosities about those who subscribe to moral relativism, and I think most of people on the woke left do subscribe to moral relativism, is that it seems to lead inexorably to moral dogmatism. You'd think the opposite would be the case. You think if you're a moral relativist, then you're going to be slightly hesitant, a bit inhibited about setting out your own kind of morals in the public square. But actually, the opposite is the case. They're relativists and ipso facto complete dogmatists. Ditto with this belief that everyone has their own truth or sees the world in their own particular way. Their lived experience dictates how they understand the world. That seems to go hand in hand with, well, my truth is actually the only truth, and if you dissent from it in any way, I'm going to set the fact checkers on you. It has caused a crisis in American journalism, to a lesser extent in British journalism too. And I think the relativism predated the capture of the kind of cathedrals of American journalism by the woke. Because, of course, if you believe nothing is true, and if you believe in moral relativism, that renders you susceptible to capture by a kind of ideological group of committed fanatical advocates as they have been. But the danger is, what's inevitable is that even as the woke mind virus begins to fade and people develop antibodies and so forth, and we develop herd immunity, so another virus, because they aren't anchored in the truth, in actually a shared set of moral values anymore, because they think all of that is redundant and indefensible, they're incredibly susceptible to being captured by something else.
The next mania.
Yeah,
definitely.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday, and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.